Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Governor Newsom is going all in on mental health reform in California, something that he says no state has ever done anything to the level that he is proposing. As part of his multi-city tour of California, highlighting what he'd like to accomplish for his second term in office, the governor announced a new round of proposals that would pump billions of dollars into the state's behavioral health war chest. The main proposal would go before voters in 2024, asking to approve a state bond measure that would fund health campuses, treatment facilities, and permanent housing. The hope is to raise around $3 to $5 billion, if not more. The plan, though, builds upon a law that voters already approved nearly 20 years ago, Prop 63. It's known as the Mental Health Services Act, which places an income tax on high earners. One of the authors of Prop 63 was Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, who was then a state lawmaker. Mayor Steinberg joins us now to explain how this will build off his original law. Good morning, Mayor.
Good to be with you, Vicky.
Okay, we got to take a little trip down memory lane when it comes to legislation. Take us back to the original bill, Prop 63, and explain to our listeners what it does and how it's been working so far.
Sure. Well, let's go back to 1998. My first year in the Assembly, I introduced a series of bills known as the AB 34 series. It was what we called Integrated Services for the Homeless Mentally Ill. We got $55 million a year, distributed to 30 counties, 5,000 people a year got wraparound services, and we showed dramatic improvements in people's lives, reduced homelessness, reduced incarceration, increased housing and employment. It was so successful that we decided if it's good enough for 5,000 people, we ought to actually build the system that was promised when Governor Reagan and the legislature back in the 60s and 70s shut the state mental hospitals and promised a decent and funded system of community mental health care. And of course, the state never delivered. So we went to the ballot and we put the millionaire's tax on the ballot, Prop 63. And it was a very eventful political year in 2004. There were a lot of controversial measures and we kind of slipped right under the radar. We raised $5 million for a statewide campaign and passed Prop 63 with 53% of the vote. What does it do? It says that 20% of the money needs to be spent on prevention, early intervention every year, 5% on innovation, and the remainder on helping people who are the sickest of the sick. It started at $750 million a year, and now it is up to over $4 billion a year. And so we come 20 years later, it's time to modernize the law. Any law after a decade or two ought to be re-looked at. And what we have seen is great success, tens of thousands of people helped, but two things we want to correct. Number one, the money needs to be focused more on the sickest of the sick, namely the people who are living in these tent encampments and people who are cycling in and out of our jails and in and out of our state prisons. The counties, which do a good job through what are called full-service partnerships, the wraparound service model, a lot of people are getting help, but there isn't enough of a state focus or a county focus on what we're all experiencing in our communities, namely this unsheltered homeless problem, which we know is the top issue everywhere. So what the governor proposes, and I support, is let's update Prop 63 to make sure that more of the money goes to helping solve that problem, treating the people who desperately need help, adding substance abuse, by the way, to what can be covered by the law, and actually making a dent on the problem, which the public is demanding, obviously, that we do so.
How do bonds work? Is it taxpayer money?
So the bond is a separate proposal. It's in addition to modernizing Prop 63. What he wants to do on Prop 63, the Mental Health Services Act, is update it to make it more focused on unsheltered homelessness, set aside $1 billion out of the $4 billion every year for housing. And then in addition, he has a proposal that would create a bond, $3 to $5 billion, to build more mental health facilities throughout the state. What he recognizes is that we have a broken system, despite the Mental Health Services Act, despite all the improvements in care and the reduction in stigma and more people telling their stories, we still have a fragmented system, and too many people don't know where to get help, and we don't have enough workers. We don't have enough of a mental health workforce. And so he wants to tackle all parts of it. And part of it is making sure that we have enough beds and enough facilities so that when people are in crisis and they get better and can step down to something other than a hospital bed or a contained facility, that there are those beds to enable people to get whatever level of help they need.
I mean, what you're talking about is a plan that envisions, you know, essentially an overhaul of the style of mental health facilities and services that we've historically been used to in the state. And that may all sound great, but those may be there may be some people who are skeptical about the amount of money that's being discussed here, $3 to $5 billion. What kind of transparency and accountability is being discussed or promised to voters if they do approve this?
So this is the other part of the governor's proposal, which I think is really significant. He is insisting, and rightfully, that whether it's the Mental Health Services Act or the bond, that those responsible for spending the money, the counties, the state itself, that they actually produce transparent outcomes every year. That's been one of the frustrations with the Mental Health Services Act. Everybody knows that it's doing a lot of good and helping a lot of people, but the money's distributed to 58 counties. There are often very different approaches and not enough outcome-based reporting. All levels of government need to be more effective and transparent in reporting outcomes. And that's part of what the governor is calling for. Mm.
On the topic of transparency, I think as we're talking now in a committee hearing, I believe, at the state capitol, there's a handful of lawmakers that are, it's a bipartisan request, that want to essentially audit the amount of money that's been spent on homelessness services. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's great. I think that we should never be afraid of sunshine, and we should never be afraid of extolling the strengths and the achievements, but also being honest about the weaknesses. That's what we're doing, what I'm doing. I mean, I have some pride of authorship in passing Prop 63. It's one of the most important things I've ever done in my life. And at the same time, I recognize that 20 years after its passage, that it's great, but not perfect, and it can be improved. And so the only way you improve it is to be clear and transparent about what's good, what isn't so good, and what can be changed.
Yesterday, we were talking about another proposal of the governor's on his State of the State tour across California, and that involved tiny homes, which Sacramento will receive roughly 350 of these units. Our homeless and housing affordability reporter, Chris Nichols, he also spoke with Wayne Weingarten. He's with the Pacific Research Institute. It's a free market think tank based in Pasadena. And essentially, he's criticized the state and the governor's spending for not finding more cost-effective solutions. He argues that state and local governments could save money by having private organizations establish shelters. What is your response to that?
Well, I think we would welcome the private sector into the discussion and the business community to say, look, I have this vacant building, I have this vacant warehouse, and be partners with us. I think that would be great. But look, the tiny home proposal or the manufactured home proposal is the essence of thinking more efficiently about housing. And frankly, we need a lot more of it. The problem we have with housing, especially affordable and supportive housing in the state, is that it's too expensive and it takes too long to build. The one-size-fits-all approach, whether it's apartments, which are wonderful, all usually high quality, and we need more of it. It can't be the only way we do things. Manufactured housing, and we saw all these incredible models. They are dignified, they're quality, they're less expensive, and they're faster to build. And so to me, I've often said we need a Silicon Valley moment when it comes to housing. We need innovation like we've never seen before. And so the governor putting forward 1,200, which, by the way, is going to be a big benefit to Sacramento because we're going to put 350 at Cal Expo. And that's going to enable us to clean up one or more of our corridors, help with the American River Parkway, and, you know, continue to make a dent in this problem here in our own city and county. It is an example of what we should be doing by the tens of thousands. And if the private sector, by the way, most of these products are produced by the private sector. And so there's a real business to be had here in a way that could help people and help the state.
We couldn't help but notice that at the Cal Expo event, obviously the governor was there, you were there, but there wasn't anyone from the county who was there. I mean, and you have said this time and time again, the county is a health and human services agency. The county and the city need to work together in tandem with each other. What was the response from the county when asked about this plan?
Well, I know that I've talked to county supervisor, chair of the board of supervisors, Rich Desmond, and he's been a great partner. And we're going to work together on all of this. Look, the city and county have a state model. It's a legally binding partnership agreement. And by the way, it will be replicated throughout the state, because what we said is that the city has its role, the county has its roles. And together we are committed to 50 new encampment engagement outreach workers so that we actually can diagnose people in the field and get them into county services right away. And then the county is committed to doing legally whatever it takes to help everybody they diagnose with a mental illness or substance abuse disorder who needs the help. And so implemented in the right way, this is as close to the right to care that I have been arguing for a long time, because now there is a legal obligation for the city and county to work together and a legal obligation for the county to add as many of those wraparound service slots as are necessary to help the people in need. We're already implementing. We're on the WX corridor. We've got three outreach teams on the WX corridor trying to clean up that part of the city in a humane way by bringing people into care. The Cal Expo offer from the governor is going to enable us to match that outreach with some actual tiny homes and beds for people. The one thing we're lacking right now is sufficient beds. We're up to 1,100 a night in the city, by the way, of emergency shelter beds, but they're all to capacity.
Yeah, I mean, the point of time count for the county is, 9,000 people on any given night that are experiencing homelessness.
We need more beds.
You have committed to demanding action on homelessness since you first were elected mayor. That was your first term. We're now in your second term. The last time you joined us in December, you were undecided, running on a third term. This crisis continues to grow, but solutions and resources continue to evolve. Will that shape your decision on whether, or have you made a decision on whether to run again? Because the primary is less than a year away.
I haven't made a decision, but I will soon. I know that it's a big buzz around town, certainly around City Hall, and I will. I will, in short amount of time. Here's what I know. Whenever I leave office, I will not have solved the problem, but I hope that what I will have done is laid the foundation, and a strong foundation, for significant improvement. And it's not all bad. I always say there are two tests. Test one is, how many people have we gotten off the streets? And I think I might have said it in December. Sacramento Steps Forward tells us between the city and the county, and they're mostly in the city, we've gotten 17,000 people off the streets since 2017. And yet there's test two, which is, does it feel any better out there? And are there still large tent encampments? Well, of course, we've got a lot of work to do to meet that test. And so I think what I have done is laid the right foundation. And the city-county partnership agreement is going to have legs for years, if not decades, because it's the roadmap to actually helping more people and having a cleaner and safer city.
In the last, 20 seconds or so that we have, did you think that we would be talking about Prop 63 20 years later?
I did not. I we had a vision that it would be fulfill that promise of decades ago. And it's fulfilled part of the promise, but the promise is never fulfilled. The work is always ongoing, and that's the opportunity we have in front of us now.
Mayor Steinberg, as always, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Vicki.
Up next, a Sacramento State professor will take us behind the scenes of her latest documentary, Lake at the Bottom of the World, which is a scientific expedition to a lake buried under 3,000 feet of Antarctic ice. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When most of us think of Antarctica, we envision a frozen and desolate landscape that beyond its coastline is largely devoid of life. But a new documentary produced by a filmmaker who is also a Sacramento State Associate Professor is changing perceptions of the frozen continent and revealing how it shaped Earth's climate by going back to the past, but also highlighting its crucial role in shaping its future. Lake at the Bottom of the World tells the story of a team of scientists and engineers following their expedition deep into the frigid world to reach a subglacial lake that's buried underneath more than 3,000 feet of ice, all to gather critical clues of how our relationship with Antarctica could impact the future of all life on Earth. Joining us now to take us behind the scenes is Kathy Kasich, the film's director, producer, and cinematographer, as well as a professor at Sac State's film program. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I watched your documentary on Amazon Prime. It was wonderful. And I've also learned that you've produced a wide array of documentaries. I mean, from the BBC to National Geographic. Where did your story for this film begin?
It began in Montana when I was living there. Sorry. And I was teaching at Montana State University. And I met a professor named John Priskiw, and he said, "Oh, won't you like to join my expedition to Antarctica? I can put you on the next grant." And I said yes immediately, and I became a principal investigator on the grant. So with this team of scientists, we all went down together. There were 12 PIs, and I was in charge of the film aspect of that.
Wow. You know, in a previous life, I was reading that you were also a biologist before becoming a filmmaker and also a professor as well. As a producer of nature films with a science background, I mean, I would imagine you have been to harsh environments in the past. But what made filming in Antarctica unlike any other environment that you've worked in?
Well, I would say that it is an absolute desolate environment, as you would imagine. It was very far from any civilization where we went. We flew 300 miles from the South Pole into the deep field, and we camped on the ice for 3 weeks. And there wasn't really much getting away from there. John Priskiw, who I mentioned earlier, said, if you need to leave, if you have a problem and we can't get a plane in, you just head to the Transantarctic Mountains over there and take a right. And that meant walking for many, many days.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was different.
I was reading an article interviewing you on this documentary, and you said something to the effect of what may be some people's nightmare was a dream come true for you. Why? How so? What makes you tick in that way?
I love wild places, and I love the feeling of really being on this planet. And I think there's probably no better way of experiencing that feeling of being on this planet than going really to the edge of it, or, well, if the bottom of it or the top, depending on your perspective, I guess. But yeah.
What is obviously for me was a huge unknown until I watched the documentary is that there are hundreds of lakes that have been discovered under the continent's ice in Antarctica. When did you discover this, and why are they scientifically significant?
Right. Well, that first happened, I think people had been theorizing lakes underneath the Antarctic ice sheet for many, many years, dating back into the 50s. But ICESat 2, which is NASA's satellite, was pinging Antarctica, and And some scientists on our project, Helen Fricker, Helen Amanda Fricker, she actually discovered that these lakes were likely to be underneath the ice sheet. And then in 2012, John Priskiw and his team, which included many of the same scientists that we did, went down to Antarctica and discovered the very first subglacial lake. And then this was the second time anybody had discovered a subglacial lake underneath the ice sheet. So that's kind of how it happened.
Yeah. On the one hand, we're obviously talking about science, but this is also a film. How did you approach storytelling?
Well, I wanted to tell the story of the expedition, but not in that kind of uber dramatic expeditionary style. I wanted to tell the story of the people and also the environment. So my filmmaking style is, I call it sensory verite, and I like to approach things from that sensory perspective, but then also provide enough context and details that you can cognitively really get something from it, but then really feel the environment and feel the sense of the people.
Yeah, there are really long pauses with natural sound where it really immerses you into what it would be like to travel to Antarctica and spend several weeks there, as you did, as well as a team of scientists and engineers. Given that the film crew consisted of you and I believe an assistant producer, Billy Collins, what were some of the biggest challenges that you faced filming in an environment that may not be very obvious to viewers?
Well, one of the biggest challenges was just that, you know, when you're breathing, you have like water vapor that comes out and freezes up your LCD screen. That's kind of a problem because you can't see when you're focusing. And we also had a UV light on for sterilizing equipment as it went down the hole. And that also was dangerous for our eyes. And so I had to wear sunglasses sometimes. I also had three rips in my tent. So there was some issues with that. I had to get that replaced.
And it was quite windy.
And it was very windy. It was very cold. The general things. Also, the lake was under a lot of pressure. So we had a camera system that was rated to 5,000 feet. But the light that we had actually leaked because it failed under the pressure.
I would imagine those learning curves were kind of unprecedented for you, but also kind of probably really good learning lessons that you can take with you as a filmmaker and cinematographer.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a wonderful experience to be there. And, the collaborations that we gained from it are, things that we'll carry with us through our lifetime as well.
Yeah. Were there ever points, because what you're talking about is that there's so much that can go wrong in conditions that are not conducive to filming a documentary or even science for that matter. Were there points throughout your journey and your trip in Antarctica where you thought that your work was over before it even really started or finished?
Yeah, definitely. When the drill broke, I was really deeply concerned that we weren't going to get to the lake because the drill, we had a hot water drill, which basically like a large fire hose that had hot water in it. And it broke because it had to be transported down there the year before and sat on the ice. And so some of the parts got brittle. So, yeah, that made me wonder what kind of film I was making. But,
And I'm correct in that there was 24 hours of daylight, right, when down there. How did you stay mentally sharp during all this time?
Well, I'm not totally sure I did the entire time, but I think that I felt as though I slept in very random moments and, 4 hours here, 2 hours there. And I used an eye mask to sleep. We worked really hard. I think the adrenaline really kept us going.
Because this was years in the making, and it came down to what, a couple weeks?
Yeah, it was 3 weeks that we were camping on the ice, 3 weeks in McMurdo, so that was 6 weeks total. But yeah, it was many years of planning since 2016 of planning, and so that's a lot of time.
What I love also is that you show these really intimate moments of levity and laughter. What are some of the moments that stick with you? I have a few that stuck with me, but I want to start with you first.
I think I always enjoyed them singing Salsa Navidad, which is a song they made up. And SALSA stands for Subglacial Antarctic Lakes Scientific Access, a very sciencey term. But they just made up a little song, and I always thought it was so cute. That, and then also everybody dancing on the LARS deck, on the deck, the launch and recovery deck. That was really fun, and I was dancing too, and so was Billy, and everybody was just happy trying to make good vibes for the project, so that was really fun.
And there were Sac State students who were also involved in the post-production, right?
That's right, yeah. Patrick McGill and Molly Fagan were two that were involved. Patrick was the assistant editor, and Molly was doing our social media. And also, Elizabeth DeClear is our producer. She's actually in the Bay Area, but she's not a Sac State student. She was long out of that.
How wonderful, being a student or even a recent graduate and having such a formative experience that really introduces you into cinematography and filmmaking and how to do a documentary right in a very compelling way, but packed with tons and tons of information. At the end of the film, I mean, you summarized some of the findings, but there were like 800 pounds of samples. I mean, what are the big findings that you wanted to highlight?
Right. Well, the biggest, I think, is that we discovered a whole new biome. And that's pretty critical, right? That they were able to look at the microbes that were underneath the ice sheet at Lake Mercer and compare them to other microbes around Antarctica and really discovered that there's a lot of life that's underneath there that's all going towards the ocean, which is changing nutrient cycling worldwide, essentially. And that's a really big deal. And then that was actually published in Nature ISME last month. And then there's another big deal is that, which just came out in Geology, is just how detailed the sediment samples that we were able to get were. They give us like hundreds of years of history of the Antarctic ice sheet, which helps us to understand climate change in Antarctica, which is critical because if we can help to understand how quickly that ice sheet melted in the past and sort of what its pattern was, we can kind of predict what happens in the future. And right now what we're seeing is that the CO2 levels, when there was no ice sheet over this part of the lake, the CO2 levels then were a lot lower than they are today, which suggests that the ice sheet itself is more in danger of collapse than we might have thought.
Yeah. You know, we only have a minute left, but when you filmed this, it was in 2018 into 2019, so that was about 4 years ago. Have you kept in touch with all the people that you profiled?
Yeah, I think we probably communicate like five or six times a month or something. I mean, we're always talking with each other over email, and then we occasionally have conference calls, and we see each other at various events. And yeah, it's a lifelong connection. And I think this film, mostly what I want people to know is that it shows a collaboration at a large scale and just sort of what you can accomplish when people really work together. When you take scientists who might normally be competing with each other, but actually here put them into a collaborative space, and how excellent that can be for understanding the research and the science.
Well, Professor Kasich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And congratulations on a wonderful documentary. Kathy Kasich is a filmmaker and also an associate professor at Sac State's film program, sharing her latest documentary, Lake at the Bottom of the World. You can watch it on lots of streaming platforms. We have all of that information on our Insight page. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When most people think of Sacramento, the first thought typically is the state capital. But the history of our region that has shaped California and the country overflows well beyond city limits. If you head east on Highway 50, you'll find the city of Rancho Cordova in Sacramento County. From the time of the Gold Rush to both World Wars and even the space race, Rancho Cordova has been a key player in all of these major milestones in American history. Airing tonight on KVIE's Viewfinder series is a special highlighting what makes cities like Rancho Cordova important to the fabric and the culture of California. Joining us is Bill George, a historian, journalist, and documentary film producer who has channeled his passion for California's back lawn into a film, Rancho Cordova, From the Gold Rush to the Space Race, which premieres tonight, 7 p.m. on Sacramento's PBS station. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
What was the experience in channeling all of your passions into creating this film?
The experience was great. People were very enthusiastic about it, and that's always a key in making a film. And also honest about approaching, it's not just a puff piece about, oh, it was all great and wonderful. They had some very tough times in Rancho Cordova. They overcame them. And 20 years ago, the voters granted them cityhood. And since then, the city has really been able to get its act together and improve, and has a tremendous, vibrant art scene going there, as well as great economic development. It's one of the biggest job creators in our whole region.
Why do you call Rancho Cordova California's back lawn?
Well, I didn't call
it the Sacramento Valley's back lawn.
Yeah, I didn't call Rancho Cordova that. That's kind of my name tag. So I've done eight or nine films, can't even remember, on California now. And back lawn to me, I was looking for a way to characterize the region because everybody focuses on L.A., San Francisco, San Diego, the coast. Nobody pays much attention to the interior of California. And that's where my ballywhack is, really. Marysville, Sacramento, and then documentaries about the towns. And I just think there is tremendous history and a tremendous accomplishment in those regions, and I wanted to highlight it.
You know, I learned a great deal about Rancho Cordova. I mean, starting off as a gold rush town to agriculture, the contributions to the military, as well as space, there's been so many transformations to a city which really just became incorporated in the new millennia, like 20 years ago. You named the film Rancho Cordova, From the Gold Rush to the Space Race. What would you like viewers to take away from your piece?
To know the tremendous impact a city of 68 or 70,000 people can have on the nation's history, on the development of the nation. Lyndon Baines Johnson visited Rancho Cordova. And the other great thing about the film was we get all this wonderful archival footage, which I didn't even know existed before I started digging into it. And I kind of came upon some of it by accident. Some guy said, you know, I've got LBJ's visit to Rancho Cordova. And it's just like a time capsule. Here's all thousands of people in the street. You know, all these engineers with their white shirts, short sleeve shirts and their ties, and they're just lining the street, waving at Lyndon Johnson. Of course, he was very outgoing. He gets out of the car and walks through the crowd, which I'm sure the Secret Service hated, shaking hands. And then he drives a short bit over to Mathern area with all the top brass. And he said, you know, well, I want to thank the people of Rancho Cordova. And he was sincere about being so important to the nation's defense in terms of the anti-ballistic missile systems and then the other things. Of course, Mather, the B-52 bombers, where they trained all the navigators, was incredibly important to world peace as well as to the United States.
And you also obviously mentioned the space race as well. And I learned a little bit about Aerojet Rocketdyne as being a significant contribution to this. In 2017, I spoke with the engineers who helped build the NASA Cassini spacecraft, specifically the Titan IV engine, as it ended this like epic 20-year voyage studying Saturn and its moons by essentially plunging into the planet's atmosphere. But that's just one example of Rancho Cordova's contribution to space exploration.
Yeah, and it was Aerojet where, they had moved up from Los Angeles. And this is kind of the way these things tie in together that really fascinates me. So they were in the L.A. area, and of course they outgrew that. So they came here, they did a site survey, and they saw all the tailings from the Gold Rush. So you built up all these huge kilns of rock, right? And they thought, well, this would be the perfect place to build these test facilities because we can blow off these engines. Nobody will hear it, and it'll give us a real opportunity to do our testing. So that's why they moved up here, and just kind of fate. So the gold rush, in a way, led to the space race directly.
What I also found particularly interesting was the diversity of Rancho Cordova, that after the end of the Cold War, the area became a haven for diverse communities and refugees from many countries. And even according to the most recent census from 2020, roughly a quarter of residents are foreign-born. How did the influx of diverse communities shape the character of Rancho Cordova?
Well, I've got a great scene at the end of the movie, and I hate to give it away, but you got to tune in to see it, folks. Anyway, and I thought, we were filming, they had a big Christmas festival, and Rancho has all of these wonderful festivals throughout the year. Big Christmas festival, thousands of people. And we're just out there filming randomly, walking around, seeing what's interesting. And all of a sudden, all these people are singing Feliz Navidad, you know, one guitar player. And you just see the total diversity of the crowd. And they're all coming together. I thought, if I staged this, you know, it would cost me tens of thousands of dollars to get all these people together. And it just occurred naturally. So it is wonderful to see. It is a very diverse city, all kinds of cultural festivals and fairs going on. And as one of the people in the film explained, you know, it's not like we have a German town or a Chinatown or a this town or that. All the people live together in the community, and that's a wonderful thing about it. And historically, Rancho Cordova has always been diverse. You know, it was really based on a land grant by William Alexander Liedesdorf, who was had his mother had an African heritage, and so he was son of a Dutch sea captain and an African woman. And from that point, there has been diversity. It came about because at the end of when Mather shut down, and then when it was closed because of the Base Closure Act, and then when Aerojet really downsized because of the cuts in the space program, there was lots of affordable housing in Rancho Cordova. The military that had all this temporary housing that had been there, where the pilots who trained for 9 months or so and then left was there. So it was great when, not great, it was tragic when the war in Vietnam ended and many Southeast Asians came, but there was opportunity there to resettle and low-income housing, get them, and then, of course, these people came in and they rehabilitated the properties, hardworking immigrants and who've gone on now generations of success.
When you talk about the downsizing of Aerojet as well as Mather, in addition to that, I mean, there's a lot of hardships, economic hardships that hit Rancho Cordova. Did that contribute to the city or making the decision for the area to essentially incorporate itself into a new city? And voters approved that overwhelmingly in 2003. It wasn't that long ago.
Right. And it was the greatest vote in favor of incorporation of any, I think, in California history. So people were overwhelmingly.
It was like over 70%.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And huge support for it. Yes, that allowed the city then to take the reins. And they discuss it, frankly, in the film. You know, they were in the county before that. And as one of the city councilmen, David Sanders, said, you know, you only had one supervisor focused on the needs of Rancho Cordova. You maybe had one or two police sheriff's units out there. Well, when you could become a city, and now you've got five city council people focused on what's going on in the city, they can go quickly and fix the problems. And I think that had a tremendous effect, yes, on the city's resurgence, one that we really see strong today.
Yeah. Given that you discuss so many events that help shape Rancho Cordova, but you had to whittle it down to 30 minutes, and that can go by pretty quickly. Did you have to make some tough decisions on what to cut and leave on the cutting room floor that you wish you could you could have squeezed in?
Absolutely. You always do. And that's in the 30-minute, which is kind of my format. yes. And there's lots more there. So maybe we'll get another film. I don't know. It'd be great to see that. But yes, certainly going into more depth. I mean, there's some great stories, though, about how, of course, Rancho Cordova was a sports powerhouse, which I thought was important to bring into the story. I'm a big history fan, and often I read history, and they never talk about the business community, the sports community. It's all government did this or that. But their athletics mainly a lot to do with the airbase. So there's a great story where they talk about how, oh, 1 year they needed a quarterback. So the football coach called the Mather commander and said, hey, is there anybody in the country that might want to get transferred to Rancho Cordova? We need a quarterback. And sure enough, it happened. So there's so many that is in the film, but there's all lots of things that you like to dig into. A lot more on agriculture I would have gotten into things of that nature. But another great story, I think, is how as World War II ended, it was amazing how many people said, and this is true of California, generally, but they came out here to serve in the military. And once they were here, they left the military. They wanted to come back here. They wanted to live here. They liked it. So they all came back out and they needed housing. So a housing developer, a farmer, developed his land, and he brought in Art Linklater, who a lot of people won't remember, but as we say in the film, he was kind of the Oprah Winfrey, big TV star. And so he did the first housing development, called it Rancho Cordova, which really gave life to the name, and they went from there. So that housing boom continues to this day.
Yeah. I mean, what this really captures, whether it's Rancho Cordova or other really charming but also overlooked areas of the state when you compare it to bigger like metro areas, is I think kind of a love letter or a testament that these areas deserve more attention and there's really important history.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And there's been a lot, you know, there's a series of books now that are out there on communities. But if you dig a little deeper, the stories are really fascinating up and down. And again, I said, you know, I'm always amazed, and I did a history of Newcastle, and they talked about the Japanese internment, right? Then they took it on. They said this was what had happened, how horrible it was, and how some of the people had actually tried to help, you know, maintain the properties and things. So people look at their problems pretty frankly. And with Rancho, they did the same thing with their fight with the county over cityhood and with the decline of the city, of the area after World War II and then the subsequent rebuilding of it. So, that honesty, what authentic, that's the word these days, it's authentic. Well, it's also honest. And they looked at it and in a realistic way. And that's why I think it works as a film. It's not a promotional piece.
Yeah. I mean, from Rancho Cordova to Newcastle, as you just mentioned, I mean, there's a great deal to learn whether you live there or not.
Right. Exactly.
Bill, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. And it's good hooking up with a former KCRA person. So we're both alums. I just wanted to say that.
We certainly are. That is Bill George, owner of Nimbus Films and the creator of the documentary film Rancho Cordova, From the Gold Rush to the Space Race, which premieres tonight at 7 p.m. on KVIE's Viewfinder program. There's also more showings throughout the week on Sacramento's PBS station. We have all of that information on our Insight page. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, you can email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We will catch you right back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.